goal of the state is to get to 50% renewable energies by 2025, so it's very possible we're already on the wave.
A look at what it would take for the state to reduce its carbon footprint. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, June 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, remembering Aleut people who were interned on Killisnoo Island during World War II.
Coming here is the closest thing you can do to paying your respects. It's the ultimate way for me to put closure on it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
A federal judge says the constitutional right to vote requires the state of Alaska to translate all election materials into native languages for voters lacking English proficiency. The Anchorage Daily News says U.S. District Judge Sharon Gleason plans to conduct a 10-day trial this month in a voting rights lawsuit brought by several native villages and elders with limited English skills. Gleason denied requests for summary judgment yesterday. She also laid out her standard for the trial, saying the state is obligated to match all English materials, including pamphlets, instructions, and ballots, with Yupik, Chupik, and Gwich'in translations. Assistant Attorney General Libby Bacalar is representing the state in the case, and she says the state will have to prove that its translation efforts measure up to those terms.
That is the statutory rubric that Judge Gleason has laid out for the parties at trial. She hasn't made any findings at all about what our program is or does.
The lawsuit alleges the state is violating language provisions of the Federal Voting Rights Act by not providing election materials in their native languages. The state defends its native language program as robust. Alaska utilities and policymakers are puzzling over President Obama's proposal to cut carbon pollution from power plants and what the rules would mean for Alaska. Around the country, the proposal is viewed as a push to get states to clean up their coal plants. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, that may not be the easiest way for Alaska to meet its target.
Look around the state for big carbon dioxide emitters, and it's easy to point the finger at Fairbanks. Southeast Alaska is largely dependent on hydropower, and South Central has natural gas. But in Fairbanks and other parts of the interior, about a third of the electricity comes from coal. Corey Bergeson, CEO of Golden Valley Electric Association, told KUAC this week, its ratepayers should expect higher bills if it has to install new emission controls.
You go in and put in additional controls to take out CO2 or limit those emissions, and you know, it's just hard to speculate on the cost, but ultimately it's a big cost.
If the rules go into effect, Alaska would have to cut carbon emissions from power production 26% by 2030. But Fairbanks isn't in this alone. The state would have to develop a plan to meet its carbon target, and Chris Rose, executive director of Renewable Energy Alaska Project, says clamping down on smokestacks is just one option.
There are tremendous opportunities both on the efficiency and the generation sector for electricity that would be applicable to a state implementation plan.
The EPA target is a reduction in carbon intensity, the rate of carbon production per megawatt of power, not the amount of emissions. Without touching Fairbanks's coal plants, Alaska, Rose says, could lower its carbon intensity by adding more hydro or wind power, or maybe with geothermal and tidal generation. The regulations also give credit for cutting demand. Rose says the state's ongoing initiative to make buildings more energy efficient will help.
The public buildings that the state owns, over 5,000 buildings, currently have a mandate to be retrofitted, a percentage of them be retrofitted by 2020.
Alaska Energy Authority Deputy Director Gene Terrio says his organization is still studying the proposed regulations, but he says the pressure to cut carbon would clearly fall on the rail belt. The diesel-fired generators in the bush are too small to be included in the carbon regulations. He wonders whether the federal government would accept an Alaska plan that doesn't reduce coal plant emissions.
We're not sure yet exactly how the EPA is going to apply those rules, if it is just a blended emissions per megawatts generated.
One thing on Terrio's to-do list is to calculate how far Alaska has already come in meeting the target with wind generation and improved efficiency. Terrio says the Susitna-Watonna Dam, still in the application phase, would also move the state toward the target. Alaska's energy policy, signed by Governor Sean Parnell, calls for producing 50% of the state's electricity from renewables by 2025. Terrio says if that comes to pass, Alaska would likely meet its EPA carbon goal 5 years ahead of schedule.
Yeah, I think if we did meet that goal, by and large, that would put us into compliance.
He says upgrading the rail belt's transmission lines would also help. With expanded capacity, Terrio says the utilities could move electricity around more efficiently, add wind generation, and accept power from independent producers, although the project would cost some $900 million.
Very positive cost-benefit analysis, even if Susitna doesn't get built. But that more robust transmission system would mean that more energy could be sourced from cleaner, lower-cost sources in the rail belt.
You can expect to hear a lot more about the carbon rules as Election Day nears.
Yesterday, President Obama announced new, costly environmental regulations. It's all part of his radical energy plan.
In Washington, Republican groups immediately saw carbon as the new health care, a controversial Obama policy to hang on the necks of Democratic senators they hope to oust in November. This is a robocall the National Republican Senatorial Committee is running against Senator Mark Begich in Alaska and against Democrats in three other states.
It's not surprising Mark Begich stands by Barack Obama's costly regulations. Because
Begich says he wants to make sure the state has the flexibility the EPA is promising, but he's not condemning the proposed carbon rules.
You know, at this point, it at least seems to us that it does not affect rural Alaska in any way. And second, as you know, the goal of the state is to get to 50% renewable energies by 2025, so it's very possible we're already on the way of matching what the requirements are.
Alaska's Republican delegates to Congress, Senator Lisa Murkowski and Congressman Don Young, both say the regulations are likely to hurt the economy. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The Canadian company that operates the Red Dog Mine in northwest Alaska says it won't build a pipeline to carry wastewater away from the mine site to the Chukchi Sea, opting instead to absorb an $8 million fine laid out in a 2008 lawsuit settlement. That settlement came after five residents from the village of Kivalina filed a lawsuit against Teck Resources, which operates the Red Dog Mine. The suit alleged Clean Water Act violations and other concerns about water discharge from the mine. At the time of the settlement, Teck agreed to explore building a 52-mile pipeline to bring the mine's treated wastewater to the Chukchi Sea. But Wayne Hall, Community Relations Manager at Red Dog, says that won't happen.
Today, Teck informed the U.S. District Court for Alaska that following extensive environmental and technical studies, the company has determined that a treated water pipeline is not a viable option and therefore will not be built.
He says Teck spent $1.7 million studying whether or not the pipeline could be built. With no pipeline, the Red Dog Mine will continue to empty treated wastewater into Red Dog Creek, which empties into the Woolock River and is used by people in Kivalina.
It's our drinking water source, but it's also our source of fish year-round.
That's Millie Holly, the IRA tribal president in Kivalina. She says a community of about 400 people just learned about Teck's filing today, and she says after years of legal struggle, they're not happy.
I'm disappointed, and I'm still concerned about the discharge that's coming out of the Red Dog Mine.
Holly says she and others in Kivalina are asking Teck for a face-to-face meeting with representatives from the mine to explain their decision. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, making the case for public preschool in the Mat-Su Valley.
I look at it as what is the biggest impact that we can give in student learning, and certainly preschool has a place in there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
After days of scientific subcommittees, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council had its first round of meetings yesterday in Nome. The council heard reports from fisheries across the North Pacific. KNOM's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
When it comes to Bering Sea pollock, catches remain flat. Glenn Merrill, an assistant regional administrator for the council, says this year's catch is almost identical to what it was last year at this time. But the Chinook bycatch within the pollock fishery is higher than last year's rates, a major issue as subsistence fishermen along the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers face unprecedented restrictions in anticipation of one of the worst king salmon runs on record. Here's Merrill.
Total Chinook salmon bycatch last year was, at this time last year, was 8,237 fish. And the current Chinook salmon bycatch is 11,536. The rates are slightly higher this year for that same metric tonnage.
Merrill says halibut bycatch is also higher by about 12% this year. In Nome, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
This morning, an advisory panel of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council heard public testimony on proposed policy changes to salmon bycatch. The panel makes recommendations to the governing board of the council, which is meeting in Nome. Members of the public testified for more than an hour, and the overwhelming theme was dissatisfaction with how managers are handling the crisis in the Chinook fishery crash. Margaret Kachiak of Holy Cross stood as she addressed the panel.
We are subsistence people. Is that a nice bedtime story I have to tell my grandchildren? So they can tell their children how the state of Alaska stepped in and just depleted every little hope that I had for my family? What are you going to give me for that? You think you're going to compensate me? It'll take your lifetime to do that.
The last member of the public to speak was George Hutchins, a commercial pollock trawler, who says the industry is being scapegoated over Chinook bycatch because the science isn't there to prove it's depleting the runs.
I don't believe that there's one single answer. You could outlaw pollock fishing tomorrow, and it's not going to bring back your salmon. You could outlaw it for 20 years, and it's not going to help.
The panel voted 11-8 in favor of a moderate approach that would increase avoidance incentives in chum bycatch, but not touch policy on Chinooks. It will go before the full council for a vote tomorrow morning. An abandoned crab vessel will finally be pulled off the beach in Unalaska more than 7 months after it ran aground. But as KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, the Arctic Hunter isn't the only wreck that's been waiting on a cleanup.
When the Arctic Hunter hit the rocks, it was 4 a.m. the morning after Halloween. Hardly anyone was there to see it, except for a few cameras from the reality TV show Deadliest Catch. A recent episode showed the Arctic Hunter's accident.
The distress call echoes across the fleet. And the closest boat capable of a rescue?
We need to get a life sling ready to pull guys out of the water.
Is Captain Elliot Meese on the 107-foot saga.
Neese and his crew helped evacuate the stranded fishermen on TV, but we don't see what happened to their vessel. Until recently, the answer was nothing.
Just a matter of having the divers go down there and torch holes in it to rig cables to it so we can pull it out of there.
That's Dan Magone, a salvager with Resolve Magone Marine Services. That company got a contract at the end of May to clean up what's left of the Arctic Hunter. Once they drag the shipwreck away, Magone says his crew will clean up boat debris that's washed up on Unalaska's beaches. It's been a big concern for locals, but Magone says you can't blame the whole mess on just one vessel.
If there's urethane foam and fiberglass and, you know, flotsam and jetsam, it's not necessarily from the Arctic Hunter.
It could be from the Chaos, another fishing boat that ran aground near Unalaska last fall and is still sitting on the beach today. Magone says he's removed a lot of shipwrecks in Southwest Alaska over the years.
you know, I've done virtually all of them out here, and I've not seen any of them get delayed as long as these two, considering that they both had adequate insurance.
It turns out there are a lot of reasons for the delay, and insurance is part of it. When a fishing vessel sinks or runs aground, the insurance company pays for the cleanup, and they also hire the crew that's going to do it. It can get complicated if there's more than one insurance company involved, though. McGone says two insurers had to look over the Arctic Hunter case before they were ready to take bids from salvage crews. There were also multiple insurers for the chaos. They decided pretty early on to use McGone's shop in Unalaska, but Jack McFarland, whose job was to help coordinate the salvage contract, says things stalled out after that.
Obviously, the salver was, you know, pretty busy on many other projects, and we eradicated the pollution immediately from the vessel.
That's mandated by the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, or DEC. Once the oil and fuel is removed, though, the threat to the environment goes way down, and there's less of a rush to get the vessel off the beach. As long as the responsible parties keep in touch with the state, they can take their time getting the wreck cleaned up. Both vessels took a beating over the winter, the Arctic Hunter and the Chaos, which is the boat that Jack McFarland's been working on.
In a way, it being broken apart might be a little easier at this stage than not, because the risk of assets initially was a concern, you know, for wreck removal assets. That the approach is pretty rocky and dangerous, and weather would have to be very stable.
It would have been a tough job no matter what, and that translates to higher costs. McFarland says that the insurance company probably did save some money by waiting to move the Chaos off the beach.
It wasn't done on purpose. It just happened to be the way this one shook out.
It hasn't fully shaken out yet. There's still no deal in place to get the Chaos cleaned up, but Dan McGone says that won't matter to his salvage company. When they start working on the Arctic Hunter wreck later this month, they'll have to pick up all the debris they find to meet the state's standard for clean beaches, regardless of which vessel it came from. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Matanuska-Susitna School District's preschool program is in jeopardy. Widening the net brings pre-kindergarten education into selected district schools. But school funding reductions may force the district to shut down the innovative program in the fall. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has the story.
The merits of preschool education are obvious to teachers of young children.
Students who attend high-quality preschool are more likely to succeed not only in school, but to graduate from high school.
That's Kelly McBride, one of the teachers who spoke up at a recent Matsu Borough Assembly meeting. But the next day, news headlines trumpeted how the Assembly shot down a move to give $350,000 in borough funds to its school district to help continue its preschool program. Matsu School Superintendent Dina Paramo says keeping widening the net in the seven communities it has been serving now depends on whether or not the district wins a state grant.
If we don't receive those funds, then we won't continue them because there is not a funding stream if those funds don't come through.
Borough Mayor Larry DeVilbiss says that the private sector can fill the need for preschool, but many parents in the borough can't afford to pay for pre-K. And having the school district provide it is a boon to hardworking couples. The issue at hand is not about the merits of formal education programs for four-year-olds, but who is going to pay for them. Paramo says ultimately the public will, one way or another.
To me, I look at it as what is the biggest impact that we can give in student learning, and certainly preschool has a place in there.
Paul Sugar, who heads the State Department of Education's pre-K program, says there is $2 million in this year's education budget to fund pre-K programs within school districts. Sugar says the state encourages districts which apply for the funds to partner with private preschools.
We were looking at ways to expand services to more folks and, if possible, to build partnerships so that we would see the strengths of other programs being infused into the school districts and the strengths that the district offers being then infused into the other works of the partners.
Paramo says that Mat-Su School District partners with Palmer's Head Start program. Last year, the state money helped 8 school districts in Alaska fund pre-K programs. Sugar says state money pays for between 200 and 300 students enrolled in public preschools each year. This is the 6th year that state money has been available for such programs. Paramo says that Mat-Su School Board has asked her to find preschool money outside of the base student allocation and that she is examining all available sources to continue the program. Paramo says the school district's preschool plan has always been scalable to fit whatever money is available, even if it is a one-time grant.
And some people think, well, that's kind of a waste of money. You'll have it for a couple of years, but then you won't. But we affected 150 kids positively that we could have. And that's why we build programs that are scalable. We try, and then we're going to may have to tell some families that we can't do it.
She says unless more money is found, only Talkeetna's pre-K will open in the fall. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
More than 70 years have passed since the U.S. government forced the people of Atka from their homes to an internment camp on Killisnoo Island in southeast Alaska. To protect them from Japanese invasion during World War II, they were moved 1,600 miles from the Aleutian Islands to an old whaling and herring village across the water from Angoon on Admiralty Island. They have not been forgotten. A group of Southeast Alaskans traveled to Killisnoo last weekend to memorialize the Aleut people of Atka. KTOO's Lisa Fu was there.
Martin Stepton digs a hole for a memorial plaque. He is overcome with tears. His wife Anne comforts him with a long embrace before he continues digging. He said he felt like he was digging a grave. Stepton is from St. Paul in the Pribilof Islands. His grandparents were evacuated in June 1942 and brought to an internment camp in Funter Bay, about 50 miles north of Killisnoo. His father was born there. He has come to Killisnoo with about 100 people on a Friends of Admiralty Island tour. Most are from Juneau. Some are past and present Angoon residents. Though Stepton's family wasn't in Killisnoo, he feels a profound connection to the Atka people interned here.
They're Aleuts just like us, and we're related to them, and they went through very similar hardships like we did, and it changed our entire history.
Stepton heard about the Funter Bay internment camp all his life growing up in St. Paul.
The things that come to my mind are the stories of the babies that were born there and didn't have the medical care to live, you know, and they were just babies and they died because they couldn't be taken care of.
Stepton now lives in Juneau and visited Funter Bay for the first time 3 weeks ago. When he heard about the Friends of Admiralty trip to Killisnoo, he immediately joined.
Coming here is the closest thing you can do to paying your respects. It's the ultimate way for me to put closure on it.
K.J. Metcalf helped start Friends of Admiralty Island in 1997 to advocate for the island's cultural, historic, and wilderness preservation. He was the first U.S. Forest Service Ranger when Admiralty was designated a national monument in 1978. Metcalf and his wife lived in Angoon for 18 years. Funter Bay was more isolated than Killisnoo. Metcalf says the Atka Aleuts, interned in the old Killisnoo herring factory, had Tlingit neighbors a few miles north.
These people were not provided any assistance at all, no medical help, no clean water, no sanitary conditions. And the people of Angoon were incredibly important in their survival because they brought goods over and helped take care of them.
Dan Johnson grew up in Angoon hearing stories from his grandparents about the people of Aka and their time in Killisnoo. He says the two communities became close.
They interacted on a daily basis, so our people always talk about remembering the people that were here and how they worked and helped each other. You know, it wasn't just our people helping them, it worked back and forth.
While Johnson says the situation in Killisnoo was deplorable, he was told of lighter times as well.
The happy moments, I guess, my grandparents used to talk about is that the people that were brought here loved their movies. Whenever they knew there was a new movie in town, they'd come rowing over to Angoon in their dories.
Few signs of the Killisnoo internment camp remain. The island now has a sport fishing lodge. It's dotted with private homes, but on the south side is a cemetery where five wooden Russian Orthodox crosses mark the graves of Aka villagers. The new memorial plaque sits atop a wooden post among the graves. Joe Zuboff is of the Deshi Tong clan of Angoon and is caretaker of the Raven House. His chant stems from the story of a crabapple tree during a big storm.
The tide came really high and it washed this crabapple tree away. And all we could do was watch this crabapple tree drift away. And this is how we refer to our loved ones that we lose. There's nothing we can do but watch them float into the other world.
A History of the World War II Aleut Relocation Camps in Southeast Alaska by Charles Mobley indicates 83 people from Aka were brought to Killisnoo in 1942. Before returning to Aka 3 years later, 17 of them died.
Departed this life from the internment camp, here laid to rest, especially Nikolai and Marfa, who are fallen asleep, O Christ our God.
Russian Orthodox Bishop David Mahaffey of the Alaska Diocese sprinkles holy water on the plaque and the area around it. He leads the blessing. The plaque in memory of the Aka people looks east. It's Orthodox tradition for altars and memorial graves to face the rising sun. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Anna Rose MacArthur, Zachariah Hughes, and Matthew Smith in Nome, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Ellen Lockyer in the Mat-Su Valley, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Join the majority of Alaskans who understand that exposure to secondhand tobacco smoke endangers their health. The toxins in secondhand smoke go everywhere the blood flows, to all organs of the body, creating cellular changes that lead to cancer, heart attack, and stroke, miscarriage, and other diseases. For more information on how to eliminate exposure to secondhand smoke, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.